I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. There is rejoicing in Philly, and in Boston, the mighty Patriots have a few days of head hanging in store. The Super Bowl was a great game, as these things go. Came down to the final play after a contest in which both teams smashed records for total yards gained. And how about the ads? Will any of them set any records? Today we examine how companies chose to pitch us last night, and more importantly, the new ways that they'll have to conjure up to pitch us in the future. Andrew Essex, a former New York ad man, says that ads as we know them are on the way out, but the need to sell is not. Andrew Essex joins me to talk about his book, The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. This is not a Tide ad. It's Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. The Philadelphia Eagles scored one of their touchdowns in last night's Super Bowl in a decidedly non-traditional manner when quarterback Nick Foles caught a pass in the end zone instead of throwing it. The tradition of companies throwing Hail Mary passes on expensive Super Bowl ads continued unabated. E-Trade, avocados from Mexico, and M&Ms all spent millions of dollars for a single 30-second spot. Beer and cars, not surprisingly, were well represented too. Perhaps the most controversial ad was for Ram Trucks, whose appropriation of a sermon by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. drew swift criticism online. So what did you think of this year's crop of Super Bowl ads? And are you one of the 400 million people worldwide who employs ad-blocking technology on the internet to shield yourself against the bombardment of ads that we're subjected to on all of our devices? Give us a call at 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR. My guest today calls the Super Bowl the high holiday of advertising, but he predicts that because of the many new ways we have to rid our lives of ads, on all of the days that are not Super Sunday, what we've come to expect advertising to be will soon be changing. Andrew Essex is the former CEO of Droga5, an advertising agency in New York that won multiple Agency of the Year awards. Its clients include Under Armour, Google, and Hillary Clinton's presidential bid. He published a book last summer called The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. Andrew Essex joins us on the line from the Argo Studios in New York. Andrew, welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what was your take on, did you watch the game last night? And
I watched every second of it.
Yeah. There are a lot of folks commenting this morning that they thought the ads were more tame than in years past. There was a lot less sex, less politics, more humor. What was your take?
Well, I tend to think of the whole thing as $500 million anachronism. I mean, it's the only day where companies take really $411 million, but who's counting, and flush a good chunk of it down the toilet, because many of us are in the toilet while they're practicing their trade. It's just this incredible spectacle that's unlike any other day in the corporate world, and the value of it is increasingly questionable.
There were some ads that caught a few people's attention. Let's listen to a little bit of the Tide ad. This is the first of several Tide ads that ran in the game last night.
Yeah, just your typical Super Bowl car ad, right?
Or a hilarious beer ad.
Or whatever ad this is.
Whatever.
But it's a Tide ad.
What?
It's a Tide ad.
What makes it a Tide ad?
There are no stains.
So, Andrew, when I first heard that ad, along with the two people with whom I was watching the game, we thought that the actor was saying Tide Dad instead of Tide ad. And it took us a little while to figure it out. Now, I'm sure we were among the, you know, very few people who mistook it. But, of course, this thing was a recurring theme during the game, and it's a Procter & Gamble product, and you talk about in your book how Procter & Gamble virtually invented advertising as we know it. What was your take on the effectiveness of that? Was that all part of throwing it down the toilet as well?
Well, it's a really good question. As you said, Procter & Gamble essentially invented marketing, and they've done many, many innovative things over their 150-plus year career. But last night they had four spots, which is really three times more than most of the other players. So they spent $20 million alone for the airtime. And again, if you divide the fact that your focus group couldn't understand the copy, and let's say half of that audience was in the bathroom at the same time, you just still have to question the value. Now, when you're a corporate behemoth like that, every inch of shelf space matters, every single sale matters, and they have the resources to spend that kind of money. I just wonder if there might be a more creative way to drop 20 mil.
What you write about how the notion of what constitutes an ad that works has changed dramatically. Is there a separate set of rules for a Super Bowl ad that works as opposed to an ad, you know, on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock?
Absolutely. So again, the Super Bowl is a complete anachronism. It's the only night where we are in front of this secular hearth, where we're all sitting on the couch. Most of us who are under, say, 25 are not just watching TV. They're on a second screen, perhaps a third screen. And very few people are paying full attention anymore. You're also living in a world of unprecedented abundance in terms of other content, all kinds of apps, all kinds of games. You just don't have the ability to command attention like you used to. And it forces brands to communicate in a more thoughtful way. So on Super Bowl Sunday, they're just basically trying to leverage all those eyeballs. But the real concern is the other 364 days when things are really different.
Does the network make any money on this? I mean, for what it costs them to have the rights to broadcast the Super Bowl, can they reclaim that money through advertising sales? Because it appears that they can't. Do I have that right?
Oh, no. The Super Bowl is incredibly lucrative, and that's why it continues this bizarre paradox that's unlike anything else in media. But just the ad revenue alone was rumored to be, according to AirDage, $419 million. So I'll just call it half a billion among friends. And that's a lot of money for one day. It's the only day when they can command those kind of rates, and everywhere else the rates for the ad inventory are plummeting because the ads themselves are increasingly ineffective, at least the traditional forms of advertising. So it is this black hole that exerts this tremendous gravitational force as the rest of the universe moves in another direction.
Because the Wall Street Journal reports last week that the new pact for Thursday night football, which Fox has gotten a five-year deal for, they paid $3.3 billion for 5 years of Thursday night football. Do you have any idea? I couldn't find it. Do you have any idea what NBC paid for this year's rights to broadcast the Super Bowl? And was it less than $419 million?
I think the larger point is it's more than you and I could ever contemplate. And the question is it a good investment? So there are very few things that aggregate that kind of massive audience. And the question is how they'll monetize it. Will it be through traditional advertising? Will it be subscription fees? There are all kinds of ways to make money off the NFL, and they still command a massive audience. It's just that the advertising, the way that we were raised, is no longer relevant to a younger crop of people that just don't understand that endless series of interruptions.
One of the things that NBC spent a lot of time doing last night was advertising the Olympics and The Voice and This Is Us, among other programs. Here's a little bit of an ad for The Voice.
Ain't nothing like sitting on a country porch with some Labrador puppies and a Clydesdale horse and a country breeze.
And me, Adam Levine, with awesome hair, on a motorcycle with a wallet chain.
So they basically wrote this highly produced mini musical that made fun of ads. It was a minute long. I thought it was very funny. For me, actually, it was my favorite ad of the whole night. I thought it was really clever and well produced. And of course, the ad revenue that they will get from The Voice is going to continue throughout the year. So that's an investment looking down the road for them.
Yeah, I thought it was a great spot, too, and it's very smart of them to tease their own IP when they have that audience so more people watch their shows and they can sell advertising against them. I thought it was far more subversive for Netflix to advertise their program that was running after the Super Bowl on another channel. So the first question is, why would NBC run that? And then secondly, the larger premise that Netflix is shifting attention to their network where there is no advertising. And that's an entirely subscription-based model. And why the experience is so much superior on Netflix is because there are no interruptions. And Netflix is clearly driving us towards a different type of future than the Super Bowl represents.
NPR did some reports this weekend that say that more millennials will cut the cord with cable in the next 5 years, that very few millennials are going to actually have traditional television 5 or 10 years down the line. YouTube had an ad last night talking about not just the YouTube content that you can get that's stored there, but also some live broadcasts, sports and whatnot. What do you make of that move?
I think it's representative of this massive paradigm shift that's happening. Young people are saying, we don't want an endless series of interruptions. We don't want these huge bundles that we have to pay for that include channels we never watch. We want an on-demand model where we can have what we want when we want it. So the whole premise of appointment TV, this is something that was so fundamental to our childhoods, is being smashed as we speak. The Super Bowl being really the embodiment of this legacy model, which is completely irrational everywhere else.
Of course, as has been the case in the last several years, there are some companies that, regardless of how much they've invested, spend Monday, the day after the game, defending or apologizing for an ad that they ran. This is one that took the severe criticism the second it ran, because I'm one of those guys who was watching another screen as the game was unfolding, and the tweets about this ad for Ram Trucks were immediate.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. You don't have to know the theory of relativity.
Here's Dr. King being appropriated to sell trucks. Now, just this morning, members of Dr. King's family have said they had nothing to do with licensing this. You know, the daughter is saying, oh, it was my brother who did it, and that's going to get sorted out over the next 48 hours, I'm sure. But when you've been in these meetings with clients where you sit around the table and say, here's our pitch, here's what I think we should do. What do you think happened in that meeting, and how did so many people miss the potential downside of this?
I'm so glad you asked me, and we could probably devote the rest of the conversation just to this one ad. I think it's redolent of the fiasco that Pepsi had in its hands last year at this time. It's not uncommon for brands to try to borrow the equity of celebrity. Usually that celebrity is Paris Hilton, Kim Kardashian. So they thought, let's take this inspiring, iconic orator and use his speech as something to give us really more, let's call it class in this particular instance, more substance. But it's really quite reprehensible. The idea that they're borrowing Dr. King's equity to sell pickup trucks seems completely tone deaf. And it's really just, it's just astonishing that these things happen. In the boardroom, there's a lot of corporate myopia. It sounds like a good idea. A small group of people making a decision, not necessarily testing it or testing it with people that are under some kind of duress or not seeing in the larger context in which it appears. But I was flabbergasted. I thought it was one of the most appalling lapses of corporate taste in recent memory, if not ever. And the interesting thing is every brand wants what's called free media, earned media, to get people to talk about the ad, but they don't want this kind of free media. And the ultimate question is, are you now going to go out and buy a Ram truck as a result of this, or are you less likely to ever even consider one? So what are the negative impacts of this from a sales perspective, keeping in mind that they spent $5 million just on the airtime, and then let's call it another one or two to make the spot? And I do think, just to belabor this point, that there should be some look into the King family and how this decision was made. I don't know what their economics are, but someone clearly went for the cash here, and that's another squandering of a legacy, which is very disappointing.
There are metrics, of course, that can put a value on the success of an ad, right? An ad runs, and then people look at the sales figures and say, okay, they spiked up X percent, therefore the ad was a good investment, it was a mediocre investment, it was a rotten investment if the sales don't spike. Are there metrics to show the negative impact of an ad on a company? Will Ram Trucks be living this thing down 6 months from now, a year from now, 2 years from now?
100%. So it's generally called social listening. So they'll scrub social media and look at the sentiment analysis, and they will see, presumably, that most of the sentiment is negative, and they'll be able to quantify that versus the positive sentiment. How many people said go Ram versus boo Ram? And I imagine there'll be some investigation into how this happened and who is responsible, and perhaps a head or two will roll. And I don't think it'll be 2 years, but they'll be looking at this for some time, and other companies will make sure that that never happens and change their approval process accordingly.
Andrew Essex is the author of a terrific book. It's called The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. When we come back from a quick break, we'll take your calls and comments. What were your favorite Super Bowl ads? Which ones rubbed you the wrong way? Do you use ad blocking technology? Or would you be willing to pay more for programming with less or even no advertising? 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. On Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's show, it's the monthly edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. We're going to talk about the social and political dynamics for women in the workplace. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Andrew Essex. He's a former journalist, magazine editor, and ad executive who has written a superb and trenchant history of the rise and fall of modern advertising. It's called The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die, and the Creative Resurrection to Come. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. Do you see the role of advertising changing from simply selling us stuff to a more noble purpose? 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can find us on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR. So, Andrew, you quote one of the great sages of the ad business, David Ogilvy, who said back in 1963 that there's no correlation between people liking commercials and being sold by them. People do, particularly the day after the Super Bowl, often, you know, recap the ads they liked, the ones they didn't like, the ones they thought were funny, the ones that just sort of fell flat. But how, because these companies are spending as much money as they're spending, and something like, as you said, $5 million for a 30-second spot last night. If people don't like the ads, that just really seems like a lousy investment from every which way you look at it.
Well, you're absolutely right. Again, the theory is you've got 111 million people watching, so you don't want to squander all those eyeballs. But to be honest, the thing I'm more obsessed with is the other 364 days a year. So Mr. Ogilvy was right back then when there were only three networks and you could command all that attention. But of course, now there are hundreds and hundreds of networks, hundreds of platforms. There are 497 scripted TV shows on the air alone. There are tons of models that don't even have advertising. So most young people are living in a world in which there are no interruptions. There are no magazine ads because there are no magazines, and they're deploying ad blocking technology. So they're simply not even seeing the ad. And that's the much larger issue for advertisers, for marketers. What happens if the canvas on which you paint is being taken away? So you have the Super Bowl, this massive anachronism, and then you have to deal with the other days. So one day when you can make a huge economic mistake, and the other days when you're invisible. It's not necessarily the greatest dynamic.
Leventhal from Chestertown writes us on Twitter, "I was disappointed that we didn't see a performance of the Clydesdales. That's the one Super Bowl advert that I always enjoy thoroughly. My reaction, this year I'll be drinking Stella Artois, Jungling, Pilsner, and Rolling Rock," right? So he's not doing Bud this year. He's going to do some of the smaller brands. Of course, Stella Artois had an ad with Matt Damon, the actor, that connected their product to the global drinking water shortage. There were a few companies deciding to be associating themselves with do-gooders, and they also do that during the rest of the other 364 days of the year, don't they? And is that a good play for advertisers these days?
I think it is a good play. I think the idea of corporate social responsibility is always compelling, especially when it's attached to a creative idea that it resonates with people. Using Matt Damon's celebrity for an issue attached to a liquid that is refreshing is probably a better way of doing it than having some silly car wash below the waist humor that doesn't really cut through, is simply not good enough. So I applaud them for trying harder. And I'll be curious to see how people will respond to that.
So the last part of your book concerns the future of advertising, and that includes having these large advertisers take on very socially necessary projects, even having to take on the huge job of tackling the nation's infrastructure problem. So I do want to talk about that in a second. But the first part of the book, you talk about ad blocking technology and the fact that so many ads that are appearing on the internet, and so far, I think Facebook commands about 17% of the ad dollars spent, Google about 32% of ad dollars spent. But there's an awful lot of people, some 400 million plus, who have figured out ways of just avoiding the ads altogether.
It's important to stipulate that ad blocking has existed since the beginning of time. So people use the bathroom to block ads, and they use the remote control, TiVo, et cetera, et cetera. But now there is a very simple web plugin that you can use on desktop or mobile that simply allows you to eradicate ads the way those purple zappers eradicate mosquitoes. And it creates a simply superior environment. There's not that clutter, the noise, the things that follow you around like a stalker. And that's a revelation. It has huge consequences, and it's the repercussions of 50 years of jamming something down people's throats that they didn't ask to see. And I think the industry is only now coming to terms with this. What does it mean when there's a technology that an individual can self-select to get rid of a message they didn't ask to hear? It forces the brands to be more thoughtful, to think about adding value rather than adding noise. And I think net-net, that's an excellent development.
You talk about the way that ad blocking has positively shaped human behavior, and you even compare it to the Gutenberg Bible and the typewriter. I mean, you really think this is a big deal, this ad blocking technology, which, as you mentioned, has been around for a long time.
Yeah, I just think it's a huge deal. Just the idea that you can go to an app store and download something that allows you to take control of your own media environment. We were always in this passive mode. I guess I have to accept these things because they're baked into the cake. But people are saying, no, I actually don't want to. And the adoption rate is off the charts. It's really, it's just showing sentiment in a way that's inarguable.
The Marine Corps decided not to do a broadcast ad on television, but rather to do an internet ad. It was an online ad only that was targeted to what they called, or NPR reported as, tech-savvy young people who have faced challenges. So, I mean, that seems like a pretty specific niche. And I wonder how many of those tech-savvy kids have ad-blocking technology that never saw it. Do you have any way of gauging that?
Well, that's a very good question, but it's not unlike Russia targeting individuals. Facebook has incredibly specific psychographic and demographic information, and an advertiser can buy that. Doesn't mean you're actually connecting with them. So you can go after audience, but you still have to give them something that they see. And I think even if they don't have ad blocking, the question is, will the message resonate? Just because you aggregate eyeballs doesn't mean you have attention.
You mentioned that people are embracing subscription models like Netflix, where you can watch programming uninterrupted. Why is it, for example, you talk about how Facebook, or maybe I read this someplace else, forgive me if it's not specifically in your book, but Facebook had about $3.4 billion in mobile advertising, I think, last year. Of course, there are 2.2 billion Facebook users. If they charged each of us 99 cents a month, you know, that would be $2.2 billion a month, you know, and we'd never have to see another ad on Facebook or another viral video for as long as we lived. Why is it that some of these, you know, newfangled technology companies like Facebook and Google are relying so much on this, what you're referring to as an antiquated model of advertising?
Well, Facebook and Google, the so-called duopoly, are also anachronistic. And these are companies that didn't exist not long ago and now are in the top 10 of market cap, and their entire product is advertising. So they are they are unique, and we have to put them aside for a minute. The larger question is, would you pay for something rather than to have it free with interruptions? That's just an interesting question. So Netflix and HBO, or the old school media model of network television? And it becomes an economic question. If you can afford to, I would argue you would. It's better to watch Breaking Bad without interruption than to have the drama interrupted by a toilet paper commercial. Question is, can you afford it? So advertising existed to subsidize the programming, and that was the exchange for watching the program for free. Now, with so many platforms and so much fragmentation and the ability to avoid ads, programmers, platforms are thinking, wait a minute, maybe we can charge people for it. But you need a product that's so good that people are willing to pay for it. And that's where the rubber hits the road. I'd be prepared to pay for the New York Times, and I'd pay even more not to have advertising attached. And can they offer me a product that conforms to that expectation?
Are you one of those readers, for example, of the New York Times, where the advertising really bothers you? I mean, does it really clutter up your life? Because I read the New York Times every day, and I don't, New York Times, read the ads. But I can skip over them just fine. I mean, it just doesn't matter. I couldn't tell you what those ads are that are embedded in the middle of those New York Times stories, because I just use my thumb and flip up.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's two forms of failure there. So for you, they're invisible. For me, they're a little bit more annoying because I see them as a distraction, because I've been in this game. I can't tune it out enough. It's like an out-of-tune flute in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. So, but both of us, we're not having a particularly engaged experience with those ads. And if the Times' entire business model hinged on those ads, that would not be good for them. But they are saying, we'll take that ad revenue, but we recognize it's in long-term irreversible decline, or it's certainly on a downward trend. And the real win for us is in subscription. And we can continue to charge because we produce a premium product that is, in fact, worth paying for. So going back to Facebook, I don't know that people would pay for Facebook unless we attempted to take it away from them. But it's really just the operating system of the internet. It's just there. And I think it's too late for them to switch their entire business model.
Our director and engineer, Luke Spicknall, who is a millennial, is shaking his head. No way would I pay for Facebook.
It's like, well,
if they start charging me 99 cents a month, I'll just bag Facebook. I just don't need Facebook. Lindsay and Frederick, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi, yes. Thank you so much for having me. So earlier you had spoken about advertising taking on a more noble purpose than just selling us stuff. And as I'm studying marketing and communications at Hood College in Frederick, Maryland, my marketing professor this semester is teaching us that that commercials and advertisements really tend and always have tended to take on and reflect what is going on culturally in the world. And I think that we saw this in some of the advertisements in the Super Bowl, such as the Budweiser water commercial. But I think that really is a great point that makes you think a little bit differently about advertisements. And it really is kind of explanatory to why advertisements such as those of the Super Bowl tend to reel us in and really, you know, draw an emotional reaction in addition to them just being entertaining.
So, Lindsay, as a college student, then, are you more drawn to ads that associate the company with a good social cause? Then, are you immediately, you know, more inclined to purchase that product, for example?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not all the time that I can support companies that, you know, are also doing social good, because oftentimes there is a price associated with that. But I definitely do have an emotional reaction to those advertisements, and I do put them in my mind as a company that I do want to support, as opposed to those companies that aren't doing social harm, that aren't doing social good, or that are doing social harm.
And Andrew Essex, you write about a company in New York, a big bank in New York, Citibank, who got behind a huge transportation innovation in New York City, and you thought that was a very good move on their part. Explain what Citibank is doing in New York when it comes to riding bicycles.
Citibike is a massive bike sharing program that didn't exist several years ago. And it basically connects the two points, the point that the caller makes and the point that I was going to make based on your previous question. So it is a great idea for a brand, particularly if they're speaking to millennials, to have a purpose, to be attached to a cause. It is a differentiator. So you're likely to go buy Stella Artois because you know that they do something good, as opposed to, again, a mindless beer brand. But at the same time, the brands are grappling with the fact that the traditional places where they advertise, those television commercials, those print ads, those digital display ads, are being disappeared. So in the case of Citibank, they connected both. They created an entirely new channel, which is this fleet of 5,000 bikes in the city of New York, all painted blue in the brand's colors. And that didn't exist before. So instead of interrupting someone's TV show, they created their own show, their own channel, and they did something good for humanity. They gave us a way to get around town that was good for the planet, that would reduce our carbon footprint and our waistline. And that was a very laudable spend there. They had the resources, but they decided to spend it in an innovative way. So they got mission and purpose, and they got their own proprietary channel. That's a triple win as far as I'm concerned, a grand slam or a touchdown, to use the appropriate metaphor of the day.
Yeah, their own proprietary channel. That's the interesting thing, because there's nobody else advertising on those bikes. It's just them.
That's exactly right. And that's true creative innovation. That's what I mean in the title of the book. They didn't turn up as the uninvited guest at someone else's party. They are the party. And that's the win for the future, like the Lego movie. Be the thing, not the thing that interrupts the thing.
Yeah. Joan from Annapolis sends us an email and says, Tom, I agree that co-opting the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to sell trucks is in bad taste. However, the silver lining is that millions of people, including me, who had never heard the speech before and its inspirational message, are now aware of it. In this case, the benefit outweighs the lack of propriety by the company making the ad.
Maybe not to dodge, though. I mean, it's fantastic if more people know about this fantastic speech, but I don't know that that was the intended consequence.
Yeah, yeah. Dodge wanted to sell a truck. Julie from Hamden says, I stream the Super Bowl on NBC's app, so I don't know if this ad aired nationally, but I was excited to see the M&T Bank commercial that featured the founders of Union Brewing. That's a brewery here in Baltimore, but was disappointed that the word Baltimore was never said. What a missed opportunity to highlight the nation, something exciting happening in our city. So again, even when you write when you broadcast, whether it's on the net or on broadcast television, a good ad, if it doesn't meet all the criteria of viewers, you could take some flack for it.
Absolutely, and you're probably more vulnerable to that flack than ever.
Annette from Bel Air writes, what did you think, Andrew, this is directed to you, of the Persil laundry detergent ad? It was aimed at men who do laundry. Evidently, that's a small sector. I don't know. I do plenty of laundry. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm sure how that works. And then in the last quarter, there was a Telemundo ad for the upcoming World Cup, again, aimed at younger men. And it seemed that consumer products were mainly missing, with an emphasis on experiences. What does that say to you, Andrew Essex?
Yeah, again, it's one of those cases where it's like putting a chip on red 52 in a massive roulette game. The odds are so high. In the instance of Purcell, I mean, I've been in this business for some time, and I was sitting with my wife, and she said, I never even heard of that brand. Is this real or is this a joke? So if you're going to communicate, you might want to make sure that people are aware of you in the first place. It's sort of like going right to third base on the first date. It's a little aggressive. I think just the messages, if you look at them in totality, completely incoherent, random, so many different techniques and tonalities, it makes you think, what is the right thing to do? Is any of it the right thing to do? Did anyone win? Was it all just a massive waste of money?
It's interesting that your wife had never heard of Persil. I've only heard of it because I happened to clip a coupon for it the other day. And when I looked for it in the store, it wasn't on the shelf. The store didn't stock it, you know. But her first reaction was, since I've never heard of it, it must be a joke. And that's kind of interesting. And rather than, oh, here's a product I've never heard of, maybe I'll try it. That's interesting.
Right. Is this some Tide commercial that's going to have a reveal at the end, like that great Australia ad by my former company, by the way, I should disclose. But it seemed like an epic fail from my perspective.
Andrew Essex is the former CEO of Droba5, an award-winning ad agency in New York, and the author of The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. We'll have more on the future of advertising when we come back from a break. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims going back 17 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides, which the paper has been keeping since 2007, and the homicide victim identifications posted on the Baltimore Police Department's Facebook page. So far in 2018, 27 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Five unidentified adult male victims from the week before have been named by police. They are Herman White, age 51, Quinintez Harris, age 26, Geraldo Freeman, age 27, Darren McCallum, age 24, and Juan Williams, age 47. This past weekend marked the third observance of the Baltimore ceasefire. No homicides were reported in our city from Friday through yesterday. Shaquana Caldwell is a 26-year-old woman who went missing last May and whose body was found a month later. Her death has now been listed as a homicide, and another unidentified adult male who was shot last Thursday died of his wounds on Saturday. His death has also been listed as a homicide. Four other people were killed in Baltimore last week. Two are listed as unidentified adult males, and two other male victims were identified as Philip Williams Jr., age 51, and Anthony Kenny. He was 39 years old. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to midday.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So what did you think of the Super Bowl last night? According to my guest, Andrew Essex, the average football broadcast includes only about 11 minutes of actual plays. There are usually about 17 minutes of replays and well more than an hour of the players and the refs standing around in between plays. 11 minutes in an entire football game. And then, of course, there are the ads. On a normal Sunday afternoon, NFL games include about 100 ads. And last night, the ads were not only numerous, but expensive. As we've mentioned, about $5 million for 30 seconds worth of our eyeballs. If you're just joining us, Andrew Essex is a New York-based former ad executive who's written an excellent book called The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, and to find us on Twitter at midday WYPR. So, Andrew, one of the basic points you make is that one of the reasons, the biggest reason that people turn away from ads is because most of the ads are just bad. And so that's, you know, I think a lot of people would say amen to that. But isn't it also the case that, for example, on the internet, Facebook and Google, they're not just selling pitches for the product. They're selling information about all of us who are clicking on some of these ads and not clicking on other of those ads. So it's not just the product. When you talk about being the thing, not the thing that sells the thing, there's this other dimension of data that people are very anxious to have about all of our proclivities for stuff that we may want to purchase at some time.
Yeah, you're talking about the potential violation of privacy and how that affects the willingness to look at an ad. So I encourage you to type into your search bar vacation in Montreal, something along those lines, or comfortable slippers, and do the same on Facebook. Click on a video about something that relates to a product. You'll start seeing ads that pertain to that particular product, and it will be relentless because you've basically just signaled to one of these platforms that you have a proclivity, whether it's German cars or fancy bath soaps. And Facebook or Google then sells that information about your psychographic tendencies And the paradox is that it makes the ads more intrusive, more like stalkers, and less likely to be seen. They have all this vaulted technological superiority, but it tends to actually backfire in some respect and makes the ads more self-conscious and annoying.
What about smaller companies? You mentioned Citibank and the City Bike Share program in New York. What if you're, you know, a mom and pop grocery store or a person who owns, you know, three McDonald's franchises or a person who does shoe repair? You're not going to be in a position to spend millions of dollars,
you
know, fixing the New York subway or building a bridge. You know, what are their options going to be in this new age?
Very few, and that's why Facebook is so successful. So going back to your shoemaker, if you're a shoemaker in a certain part of Baltimore with an expertise, you want to aggregate audience that's interested, receptive to your product. And that's where it's hugely, hugely helpful. Doesn't mean that you can still bombard them with noise. You have to have a thoughtful message about what you do, more than just a digital equivalent of a sandwich board. But there's no doubt that those entities, those platforms, can deliver audience with a specificity that's unrivaled. It's just that it creates a new set of rules, and those rules have to be taken seriously.
Here's another comment about the ad that involved Dr. King's sermon. This is from Paul, who tweets, going back to the Dodge King ad, out of all the ads that came on, nothing got the adults, got all of the adults in my house to stop talking than hearing Dr. King's voice. So maybe Dodge got the attention grabber right. So grabbing our attention is one thing. Getting us to be inclined to buy their truck as opposed to a Ford truck or a Chevy truck is quite another thing.
Right. And that goes to the fundamental existential question of a Super Bowl ad. So sometimes you can do something really funny and people forget who's attached to it. Who did the Talking Frogs for many years ago? Do you know the brand?
No, I have no idea.
So it was Budweiser in that particular instance. Does that sell more beer? Still hard to quantify. In this particular case, there's nothing like Dr. King's voice to stop a room from speaking. But will you go out and buy a Dodge truck? Or are you less inclined to buy a Dodge truck? That's the thing that has to be explored. Attention is one thing. Intention is another thing, and that's really what an ad is supposed to do. It's supposed to move the merch, and I think they did the exact opposite.
So Eris writes, Persil, the laundry detergent, was given a higher rating by Consumer Reports than Tide. So maybe Eris knew that before the ad ran last night, or maybe this is a new piece of information added to the...
Or we have a plan from a Persil employee.
Yeah, or we have a plan from a Persil employee. The fact that... for example, you quote Google chief Larry Page back in 2015. He was addressing a meeting of shareholders, and he said that we need to make ads less annoying, again, because of this fear of ad blocking technology. So, and at one other point in the book, you say ad executives have a responsibility simply not to outrage customers instead of selling them. So that struck me as quite an interesting statement from an advertising executive, or maybe a reformed advertising executive, because I mean, I thought that that's why companies paid ad agencies all this money. It's to sell their stuff. But you're just saying basically the you got to lower the bar of aspirations there a little bit.
Well, overt selling in any form is obnoxious and it rarely works. People are attuned to that. And people live in this environment of unprecedented clutter. There's so much content out there, and anything that's secondary, that's rude and uninvited, is usually met with a certain amount of derision. So the pivot here is to just simply be more creative and to wrap the selling in something that people want to see. And I use the Lego movie as the perfect example of this, which is a feature film that happens to be one of the greatest commercials ever made, a pure piece of entertainment that also sold a lot of merch. It doesn't have to be something secondary. It doesn't have to be something interruptive or obnoxious. It can be utility, entertainment, just something that makes you feel a little bit better about the day, or a coupon, like you said before, that takes a little load off your wallet. But this is the real challenge to marketers. Don't annoy, inspire, and add value.
And the Lego Movie also grossed $400 million. It wasn't like they lost money making the movie. I mean, you know, you got to sell a lot of Legos to make $400 million, it seems to me.
So think about that. You can pay $5 million for 30 seconds of space on the Super Bowl, which you then have to fill with a message, which costs money too. Or you could go out and be the Super Bowl yourself. And I just think that's certainly a better strategic direction.
Steven writes, speaking as one of those dreaded millennials, I for one hope that the next industry that we kill is advertising. Advertisers feed on human time and attention and give us nothing in return. Any attempts to appeal to my generation come off as cynical and transparent. The only reason I buy anything these days is if a friend or a family member recommends it to me in person with real words. And I don't think I'm alone. I may buy this book based on the first half of the title alone. So thank you for including real words in your title there, Andrew. Good move. But that's exactly the demographic that you're talking about. That's exactly, Stephen is exactly the person you're talking about, where for him, advertising simply has no value whatsoever.
And I think I would say to Steve, I bet you love brands, you just hate advertising. And I would argue if we got him in the studio here and we talked to him about Lego or City Bike, he'd be less appalled. It's just he doesn't like this idea of ham-fisted, one-dimensional, transparent selling, and he finds that offensive. And he is a representative of an entire generation that has been raised in a world where it's more offensive than ever. And the question is, what will brands do to get his respect back?
And you assert in this book that millennials in particular care more about bad ads than they do about privacy, so that they are willing to sacrifice some privacy as long as they can escape the bad ads.
Yeah, I'm probably going to enrage half, if not all, your listeners, but I think the privacy issue is somewhat overblown. Let's face it, we're already giving our social security numbers and our purchasing habits to the IRS, and a lot of our information is known already. It's just that when that privacy is violated in the form of an ad that follows you around the internet, it backfires. Don't take advantage of the information that people are giving you if you're a brand. Offer them something that they want. Understand when they're receptive to a message. Think about what they really need rather than what you think they need.
And when it comes to like things like the Lego Movie, which, as you mentioned, is this fantastic 90-minute ad for Legos, that's very different than what used to be referred to as product placement. So there'd be entire divisions of Coca-Cola that would be involved in making sure that the scene in a movie had on the table a can of Coke. But you say it seems like Steven is one of those kinds of guys that comes off as completely inauthentic.
Completely inauthentic. The Lego Movie is an entirely different thing than product placement. So product placement is just another form of interruption when something is jammed in there that is just completely jarring and so clearly pay to play. I think I'll drink some of my delicious Coca-Cola now, says the main character. That's just completely inauthentic, as you said. However, if the brand makes the content or underwrites the content, it's a much older and much more credible model. Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, for those who remember, GE Theater. A brand can underwrite the program or present the program in a way that makes them just a patron of the arts. And I applaud that model much more than interruption or product placement.
Because you're suggesting to companies like Verizon that they literally fix the New York City subway system. That's a better expenditure of their dollars than ads on television.
But I just want to be careful about one subtle distinction there. Not that they go out and do it because it's an act of municipal responsibility or they want to just hug trees or be associated with water scarcity or whatever issue is resonating with young people. It's because it's a channel where people are receptive to messages and the channel is broken. So in New York City, we have a bit of a crisis with our transportation system, and you've got a lot of people sitting there trapped, responsive to messages. And if a brand could help make that experience more pleasant, more effective, they would be rewarded with the warmth that our friend Stephen is not necessarily sharing at the moment.
Well, this is a fascinating book, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk about it. It's been a wonderful conversation about a really provocative book. So thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Andrew Essex is the former CEO of Droba5, an award-winning ad agency in New York. The book is called The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. He's joined us from the Argo Studios in New York today. We want to thank The Diz for supplying lunch. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street. Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. They are on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Coming up on the show tomorrow, it's the Midday Culture Connections, our monthly conversations with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're going to talk about what's going on with the dynamics of women in the workplace. Sherry and I will be joined by Michelle Chen of The Nation magazine. Again, that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. That's it for us today. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's after a news from NPR at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.